went out tonight to hear Dr. Anderson this evening, and then Dr. Anderson and Nathan Sasser tomorrow. So Dr. Nathan Sasser right there, Dr. Anderson, who will come up in just a second. So we're excited to have these guys in share on this topic, which is basically equipping us to be good evangelists and sharers of the gospel. So there's a lot of aspects of sharing the gospel with someone else, and so they're going to help us with a lot of the thinking parts, thinking well as we do that, thinking well about ourselves and the gospel that we possess, and also thinking well about the person that we're talking to and what they might be, the perspective they might be coming from. So we're very excited about that. If you're a guest with us, we're especially glad you're here. We would like to give you a book. So if you're a guest, could you raise your hand? We have two books we would like to give you. So okay. How about one to each of you? Thanks, Jimmy. Now you don't have to buy it. It's yours. There you go. We'll give some more away tomorrow. So Dr. Anderson, want to say a few words about him before we greet him and welcome him. Actually, let me back up the schedule. So the session tonight will run about an hour or so, and then tomorrow we'll be back for 9 o'clock for the first session. I have that right, John, right? Yeah, 9 a.m. will be the first session in the morning, and Dr. Anderson will give two sessions in the morning. We'll break for lunch from 11:30 to 1, and then we'll come back at 1 o'clock for Nathan's session, and then we'll finish the day with a Q&A. So I'll moderate that. These two will be up here, and then we'll give you a way to feed me questions that I can then feed to them, and they can answer. So that's our schedule. Out there is our lobby, of course. We have some light snacks, some water. If you go out and take a left, that's where our bathrooms are, our men and women's bathrooms. We have a bookstore will be open before and after the sessions. So we have some copies of Dr. Anderson's books and some other titles available to you. So that's the layout of things. So Dr. Anderson, born in England, and then at 12, correct, moved to Scotland, and then came here after he finished all his education, came here to work for RTS in Charlotte, Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte, and is he told us tonight he's progressing toward becoming a U.S. citizen, no small thing. So his background is first in computers. So his first set of degrees was in computer engineering, computer science. So he got actually a PhD in computer science. And we asked him, what was it that switched you from computer science, which sounds different from philosophy? Don't get me wrong, I'm no philosopher, but that sounds different. And so he basically said, as he's in this very secular computer engineering environment, he started to study apologetics so he wouldn't look stupid in front of his coworkers, which we could all relate to, right? Isn't that one of the reasons we're here? That we can talk to people who are unbelievers and not look stupid. So that was helpful to relate that. We can relate to him in that. So then from there, he switched over to extensive study in philosophy. And as I said, about 10 years ago, came over to the U.S. to work for Reformed Theological Seminary, and that's where he's been. Three children, his wife Katrina, and so he's a busy man, an ordained pastor, and actually goes to Sovereign Grace Presbyterian Church in Matthews, North Carolina, which is where Jonathan Walton is, if you know him. So that's some of his background. He has two of the titles that we've, one of the titles we gave away, Why Should I Believe in Christianity? A lot of the material that you're going to hear is connected to that book, and then the other title, which I have up in my down in my seat, which is the worldview book, which is called What's Your Worldview? I'm sorry. Yeah, it's called What's Your Worldview, which is it's a clever approach on that topic. It's a choose your own adventure. I don't know if you guys ever did a choose your own adventure book, but it's a choose your own adventure to help you understand what your worldview actually is, and then of course with an appeal to make it the right one. So it's a very clever way to approach that topic. So we're excited to have him for his breadth and his depth, but also his ability to communicate with people like us and equip us to talk to people that we love and want to be saved and to know the saving message of Jesus Christ. So Dr. Anderson, thank you for the time you've invested in making this possible, and we're just excited to have you. So let's welcome him through our applause.
Well, thank you, Daniel, for that warm welcome, and good evening to everyone. I have to say it's really a great pleasure and privilege to come and speak to you and share with you this weekend. I hope we're going to have a good time, a useful time together. I'm especially glad to be coming and speaking at a Sovereign Grace Church. I know a bunch of people from Sovereign Grace Churches, and I've taught at the Sovereign Grace Pastors College for a number of years, and everyone I've known from Sovereign Grace Church has been a good person, so I'm very pleased to be here. I think that maybe if I wasn't an infant Baptist and if I spoke in tongues, I'd probably go to a Sovereign Grace Church. I don't know. But anyway, it's good to be here. Well, our topic this weekend is going to be having gospel conversations. That's the title of the weekend, and really everything that I'm going to be saying is gearing towards equipping us and giving us confidence to have the gospel conversations that we need to have and hopefully that we want to have with the people around us. But in order to get to that, there's some other material that I want to deal with that's really in the realm of what we call Christian apologetics, defending the faith, thinking about why we believe what we believe, and helping other people to understand why we believe that Christianity is true. So let me get started with our topic tonight, and I'll explain what that is in just a moment. But I want to begin by inviting you to join me in a thought experiment. A thought experiment, if you're not familiar with the term, is the kind of experiment that philosophers do. Philosophers do experiments, and the kind of experiments they do are thought experiments. And thought experiments are great because they're very inexpensive. They don't cost anything. You can do them anywhere, just sitting at home on your couch, and there's absolutely no danger of blowing yourself up or poisoning yourself or anything like that. So not like the kind of experiments that are done in a laboratory. Thought experiments are very safe, and this one is going to be very safe. Well, here's what I want you to imagine and to think through, okay? Imagine that someone in your church falls very ill. Very suddenly, they fall very critically ill. And they're taken to the ER, and the doctors check them out, and they do all the kind of tests that doctors do. And they say, this person, we'll say that it's a lady, this lady is in a very, very serious condition. And if her condition does not improve, then she's going to be dead within 24 hours. It's that bad. We don't know what's caused this. We don't know. We can see what the symptoms are, but we don't know what's caused this. We don't know how to treat it. We're going to try some things, but things are not looking good. What would you do in a situation like that if someone in your church was in that situation? What would your church do? Well, I hope you would pray. Hope that's the first thing that you would do, that you would pray about the situation, and you would pray urgently. You wouldn't put it off and say, oh, I'll leave it till next week. No, you're going to pray immediately, and maybe your church would even come together and hold a prayer vigil, an urgent prayer vigil, maybe even praying through the night for this lady her condition would improve. Well, suppose that's what happens. Suppose that your church does come together, and you pray fervently for this lady, for this sister in Christ. And in the small hours of the morning, you get a report that her situation has suddenly turned around. She's suddenly started getting better. She's started making a recovery. And the doctors can't explain it. Nothing they've done explains why this has happened. None of their treatments were working. But she gets better. And within a matter of hours, she's come out of critical condition, and she's become stabilized. Well, what would you think about that situation? The doctors have no explanation for what happened. Some doctors might even use the M word, miracle. How would you interpret that series of events? This woman became critically ill. You, as a church, came together to pray for her, even though, humanly speaking, her situation looked desperate. And then within hours, her condition turned around and she's made a recovery. And in fact, she's getting out of hospital. How would you interpret that? Well, I think you would interpret it as a divine intervention and as an answer to prayer. You would say that the Lord answered your prayers. Now, maybe it was through providential means, maybe it was through supernatural, miraculous means, but you would interpret that as an answer to prayer. Well, your church would be rejoicing over this, wouldn't you? And you would be rejoicing. And maybe you're really stoked up about this, and so you go into work the following week, and you have a colleague, let's call him Bob, and Bob is an atheist. Bob is, in fact, a really strident vocal atheist. He's the sort of guy who's read everything by Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is his hero, and he thinks all religion is just superstitious, mumbo-jumbo, it's nonsense, and he's very critical of religion and Christianity, and he loves to poke fun at your Christian beliefs. Well, you say to Bob, you say, Bob, you're not going to believe this. Wait till I tell you this. There was a lady in our church who became very, very critically ill. She went to the hospital. The doctors could do nothing for her. They said she was going to be dead in 24 hours, but nothing they could do would save her. She looked as though she was going to die, but our church came together. We prayed fervently for her to the Lord, and she got better. She's been healed. Things turned around. The Lord answered our prayers. What do you make of that? Well, what would Bob say? Well, he's going to say something like this. Wow, that's amazing. There is a God after all. What time's your Sunday service? Well, you laugh, you cynics. He might say that. He might say that. Stranger things have happened. But more likely, he's going to say something like, nah, that's not what happened. That's not what happened. What happened was that there was some natural explanation. He's going to say there's some natural explanation for what happened. The doctors don't know what it is, but someday we'll figure out why these things happen. And the fact that you prayed, just coincidence. Of course you're going to pray, but you know, you're just saying words up into the air. Nothing's really happening. There is no God who answers prayer. So there's a natural explanation for this. There's a scientific, rational explanation for this. And we may not be able to say what it is now, but one day, science will be able to explain why these things happen. That, by the way, is the faith of an atheist. One day, science will explain. Why this difference between your interpretation of events and Bob's interpretation of events? Because on the face of it, you're seeing the same things. The facts, as it were, are the same for both of you. I mean, you could look at the medical records. You could get testimony of the doctors. It's not in dispute that your church prayed, came together and prayed. That happened. You did that thing. So the basic facts are well established. You could see the results of the medical test. You could go and interview this lady, find out that she's better and so forth. The facts are not really in dispute, but what differs, of course, is the interpretation of the facts. You and Bob have radically different interpretations of that course of events. Why is it that you have such very different interpretations of what happened? Well, the answer is this. He has a very different worldview than you do. He has a very different worldview than you do. And that is going to be the topic of a lot of what I'm going to say this weekend about the idea of a worldview. What a worldview is, what an impact a worldview has on the way that people think about the world and think about the events that they experience, and how we can use our understanding of worldviews to open the door to gospel conversations, which is really where we want to go. Okay? So let's start in this session just by thinking a bit about worldviews, what they are, and how why it's useful to think about them. What in the world is a worldview? Here's a simple definition to start us off. A worldview is a way of viewing the world, just a way of viewing the world, just as the word suggests. It's not a physical view of the world, like you would see, you know, a view of the planet Earth from a space station, not that kind of world view. Rather, it's a philosophical view of the world. And of course, not just of our planet, but of all of reality, the entire universe, everything that exists. A worldview is like an all-encompassing perspective on everything that exists and matters to us. That's the basic idea. Here's a slightly more technical definition of a worldview, and there are different ways of spelling it out, but here's a definition that I think is fairly useful. A network of ultimate beliefs, ideas, and assumptions about the universe and our place in it that shapes how a person understands their life and experiences and the lives and experiences of others, and also shapes how that person acts in response. There's a lot packed into that, of course, and we'll do some work to unpack it, but hopefully you get the basic gist here. Ultimate beliefs, ideas, values, and assumptions that shape how a person sees things, how they interpret things, and how they respond, how they act in the world. A worldview is sometimes called a world and life view. A world and life view, because it's not just about the world, it's about the lives that we live as well. But just because world and life view is a bit of a mouthful, I'm just going to use the term worldview from now on. So what can we say about worldviews? What are some useful things to know about worldviews? Well, here's the first thing. Worldviews are like belly buttons. Everybody has one. It's just that we don't talk about them all the time. Or in fact, perhaps a better analogy would be a worldview is like a cerebellum. Everyone has one, but not everyone knows that they have one. If you didn't know that you had a cerebellum, I can assure you that you do. It's a very important part of your brain. If you didn't have one, you probably wouldn't be here tonight. But not everybody knows that they have a cerebellum, and a worldview is like that. Everyone has a worldview, but not everyone is aware that they have a worldview. So the question isn't whether a person has a worldview, but rather, what kind of a worldview do they have? And are they aware of it? Are they thinking critically about their worldview? If you are a Christian, then you have a Christian worldview, or at least you ought to have a Christian worldview. Sadly, it doesn't always work out that way. There are people who profess to be Christians who actually don't have a Christian worldview. And we're going to spend some time unpacking a Christian worldview tomorrow morning. But that's first thing to know. Everyone has a worldview. A worldview involves what I call big question beliefs. Big question beliefs. Beliefs that address or answer the big questions of life. The questions that people have asked since the dawn of time. Is there a God? And if so, what is God like? What is the meaning of life? Does life have any meaning? What is the purpose of my life? What is the good life? How should we live the good life? What does it mean to live a moral life? Is the world of sense experience real? The things that we see and touch and hear, are they real things? Is that reality? Why is it that when you drop your toast, it always lands butter side down? No, that's not one of the big questions, although we do ask it. But a worldview involves those kind of big question beliefs. So not every belief that a person has is part of their worldview. Not every belief that a person has is part of their worldview. Only those beliefs that really have a sort of foundational, philosophical, or religious significance. So, for example, if you have the belief that American football is the greatest sport ever invented by man, that is not part of your worldview. Or at least it shouldn't be. There's something kind of wrong if that's part of your worldview. These are the big question beliefs. What else about a worldview? A worldview, we might say, functions like an intellectual filter, or rather like a pair of spectacles, metaphorically speaking, sort of mental spectacles, maybe even a pair of colored spectacles that colors things or at least affects how we see things. The reason I say that is because a worldview affects what you see in the world and how you see it. I'm going to illustrate this in a few ways, starting with a visual analogy that may just sort of help impress this idea upon you. Here's a message that reflects the world as it is, or at least as we as Christians understand it. The message is, there's wisdom in our God's book. And it is multicolored to reflect something of the variety and the diversity in the world as God has created it. Now, what I would like to do at this point is ask you to pick up the green-tinted spectacles that I've given you and put them on. But I can't afford to buy so many pairs of green-tinted spectacles and ask you to put them on, you know, spectacles with green lenses. But instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to simulate what you would see if you were to put on a pair of green-tinted spectacles. This is what you would see. It's a very different message now, isn't it? A very different message. It's got distorted. It's got corrupted. There are things missing that ought to be there. But that is what happens when you have the wrong worldview. That is when you have a worldview that doesn't actually fit the way the world is. You become blind to some things. Some things get overemphasized, some things get underemphasized, or misinterpreted, or corrupted. Now, of course, that's just a visual analogy. Okay, that's not really how a worldview works. But I could give you a number of examples of how people see the world differently because of their worldviews. In fact, the first example is the one I gave right at the beginning. That example of someone who makes a recovery from a medical condition when the church prays for them. A Christian interprets that as an answer to prayer, whereas an atheist would interpret it in some sort of naturalistic fashion. Another example, which I think you'll be able to appreciate, is the debate over evolution versus creation, which is a big debate and has been for some time in our culture, about whether the Darwinian theory of evolution is true or whether some creation view or an intelligent design theory is true. Of course, there are some people who say that the evidence in favor of the Darwinian theory of evolution is overwhelming. For some reason, they always use that adjective. It's always overwhelming evidence. I don't know why. But people say, look, the evidence for Darwinism is overwhelming. But then there are other people who look at the evidence, and I'm one of them, and say, sorry, I don't find it persuasive. I don't see it at all. When I look at the natural world, when I look at living organisms, when I look at the complexity and the arrangement of their parts, I see design. When I learn about the code in DNA, the information content in DNA, I see design. I see the hand of a creator. I see the fingerprints of a creator. Why is it that people so radically disagree about this? Is it because the people on one side are very, 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 very smart and the people on the other side are very, 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 very stupid? Well, I don't think that's the case. There are smart people, very smart people on both sides of this debate. Is it that people on one side have got access to evidence that the people on the other side don't have? They've got, we've got this evidence, and if you had this, then you would understand. Well, no, the evidence is all out there. You know, the fossil record, the structure of DNA, the structure of living organisms, all of that evidence is public evidence. Anyone can examine it for themselves. Why is it that people disagree so radically over this? Well, I think the answer, and I'm not the first person to make this suggestion, I think the answer is that people come to this scientific evidence with very different worldviews. If you come with a naturalistic, atheistic worldview, then you have to interpret the evidence in a sort of Darwinian fashion, because there's no other explanation for where things could come from. Whereas if you believe in God, then you have a very different worldview, and you look at the same evidence, and you can see very clearly the marks of design and intention, and indeed beauty and creative order. Worldviews are really what make the difference. It's not the evidence per se, it's the worldviews that people bring to the evidence. Since worldviews affect how people see the world, how they interpret the world, it turns out that worldviews largely determine people's opinions on matters of ethics and politics. Think about all the big issues that get debated today: abortion, euthanasia, same-sex relationships, gender identity, public education, what kind of education children should have, the role of government, economic policy, environmentalism, foreign policy, animal rights, genetic enhancement, all this panoply of issues that are getting debated today, and people line up on either side. The views that people have on these issues are determined more than anything else by their worldviews, the worldviews that they bring to these issues. Now, people have different worldviews, but they tend to fall into particular types. There are certain categories of worldviews that people tend to fall into. In this respect, worldviews are a little like cars, okay? Think about the car that you drive, okay? So I drove today my car, which is a Honda Civic, okay? I've seen very similar cars. I've seen other Honda Civics on the road. They're the same type of car. Two Honda Civics are the same model of car, and they're very different from a BMW, for example. So there are some people who drive the same sort of model of car. And it's like that with worldviews. Although my Honda Civic isn't identical to every other Honda Civic, we can see that it's the same basic type of car. Okay? And it's the same with worldviews. And so there is such a thing as a Christian worldview. And that will, in fact, be our topic tomorrow morning. But there are other kinds of worldviews that are very common, and I'm going to talk about a couple of those tomorrow as well, maybe help you to understand why people see the world the way they do and how we can have some productive conversations with people with very different worldviews. Now, can a person change their worldview? We've said everyone has a worldview, but can a person change their worldview? Well, yes. Yes, a person can change their worldview. You aren't stuck with the same worldview all your life. People do change their worldviews. For example, atheists become Christians. Some very famous examples, like C.S. Lewis, for example, was an atheist, became a Christian. Change, radical change of worldview. But a worldview is a little bit like a house. Mixing the metaphors here. A moment ago it was cars, now I'm going to talk about houses. A worldview is a bit like a house. You live in it, and you get very comfortable in it, and you call it your home, and you become somewhat attached to it. It's relatively easy to make small-scale changes to your home. You know, you could change the carpets, you could move the furniture around. Right now, my wife and I are repainting some of the doors. I mean, it's a bit of a hassle, takes some work, but it's, you know, it's not hugely traumatic. But moving home altogether, up and relocating to another house, changing your house, is actually quite a traumatic experience. And people are resistant to do that. You wouldn't do it unless you really had to do it. Well, changing your worldview is like that. It's a big deal. It's part of what we would actually call religious conversion. Religious conversion. Although in biblical terms, a true conversion is more than a change of worldview, it's certainly no less than that. If your worldview didn't change when you became a Christian, then something went wrong somewhere. So people can change, but it is hard to change your entire worldview. Now, I've introduced you to the concept of a worldview, but why do I think this is important? Why do I think the notion of a worldview is important? Well, here are some of the benefits of thinking in terms of worldviews, and I hope you'll see this over the course of the weekend. Here are some of the benefits of what I call worldview thinking. Firstly, sort of a biblical rationale. Christians are called to do many things. One of the things I think we are called to do is to think Christianly. I don't think that word's in the dictionary. Maybe I made it up, but could be a word, right? Makes sense. In a Christian way. Christians are called to think in a distinctively Christian way. Think of the greatest commandment. Love the Lord your God with all your mind. Think, use your mind in a God loving way, to think the way that God meant you to think. Romans 12, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Part of what it means to be a Christian, to grow as a Christian, is to think in a more consistently Christian way. And one of the ways we do that is by developing and applying a Christian worldview. It's not the only way, but it's a good way to do it. Here are some other benefits. Every religion that's out there in the world reflects a worldview. It reflects, it expresses some sort of take on reality, on the way the world is, who we are, where we came from. Islam, Mormonism, Hinduism, actually there are many varieties of Hinduism, Buddhism, likewise, different kinds of Buddhism. But all of these religions and religious traditions have an underlying worldview. They're promoting, they're advocating a certain kind of worldview. And it's not just true for religions. Every secular ideology that has ever existed, that has ever been promoted, reflects a worldview as well. Behind it is a worldview. Marxism, Darwinism, postmodernism, all these isms that you hear about, they typically reflect some kind of worldview, or they are being driven by an underlying worldview. And that means that thinking in terms of worldviews can help us in a number of ways. Thinking in terms of worldviews helps us to understand why people see the world the way they do. Because some people seem to have some very crazy beliefs, or at least beliefs that are very, very different than ours. Why do they see things the way they do? I talked a moment ago about different attitudes to the scientific evidence for Darwinism. There are people who think the evidence is compelling, others who think that it's far from compelling. What explains that difference? Why is it that when those planes hit the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, why is it that some people interpreted that as an act of terror and mass murder, and other people in the world interpreted as a great victory, a great triumph, a profoundly moral and righteous act? And there were people who saw it in that way. What explains that radical difference? Or the debate that is more heated today than ever over abortion rights, or so-called abortion rights. Why is it that some people think that abortion is murder and others people think it's a matter of human rights? It's worldviews. The worldviews explain why people see things so very differently. Worldview thinking also helps us to make comparisons between different religions or different ideologies. How do you compare something like Islam with postmodernism? I mean, how can you even, isn't that a category error? How do you compare Islam to postmodernism? Well, once you recognize that both Islam and postmodernism reflect a worldview, they have they represent a worldview, and you know how to compare worldviews, then you can make an intelligible comparison between those two viewpoints. Or Mormonism and atheism, or for that matter, Mormonism and biblical Christianity. They're actually very different worldviews. Worldview thinking helps us to see clearly the differences between them. What's more, worldview thinking helps us to make reasoned evaluations, critical evaluations of different religions and ideologies. If you know what a worldview is, and you know how to evaluate a worldview, then you know how to evaluate any religion or secular ideology that you encounter, even if you've never come across it before. Even if you've never encountered a certain religion or viewpoint before, if you can recognize that it's a worldview and you can break it down into its components and think about how to evaluate it as a worldview, then you know how to handle it. And then, fourthly, worldview thinking helps us to have constructive conversations with other people. It can actually help us to have constructive conversations, conversations that actually go somewhere, that actually get to the root issues. And by other people, I'm not just talking about fellow believers, but of course, unbelievers. And I'm going to say more about this in our third session. I'm going to apply some of this material to evangelism, how we can use this, sharing the gospel with people. So I've said something about what worldviews are and the benefits of thinking in terms of worldviews. But at this point, I need to issue a kind of a caution. This would sort of be the small print, but I want to actually make the small print big print and give you just a warning not to take some of what I'm saying here too far. It is possible to overdo worldview thinking. I think worldview thinking is very important, very helpful, but it's possible to overdo it. You see, worldviews aren't the whole story. We are more than our worldviews. We aren't just walking worldviews. Of course, there's much more to us than our worldviews. Human beings are amazingly and, we would have to say, sometimes frustratingly complex. That's just the way God made us. We're very complex beings. We are an integrated complex of body and soul. There's the material aspect of us, there's the spiritual aspect of us, and even then you can make further distinctions of our complexities. And we have minds, of course, and our minds are a very important part of us, but our minds aren't the only part of us by any means. We have thoughts, what we might call the head. We have affections, what we might call the heart. And we also have behaviors, our outward behavior, what some people have called the hands. We have the head, the heart, and the hands. And these aspects of us are closely interrelated. Our thoughts, our affections, the way we feel, our emotions, our feelings, and then the way that act, the way that we behave, the way that we outwardly live, all of these are interrelated in quite a complex way. What this means is that while a person's worldview will have an impact on their affections and will have an impact on their behavior, you can't fix a person just by fixing their worldview. You may well have to fix their worldview, or at least it needs to be addressed in some way, but I don't want anyone to go away thinking if we can just give someone the right worldview, then they'll be right through and through. That's not how it works. Christian discipleship has to be more than just worldview training, okay? I think worldview training is important. That's why I'm talking about it this weekend. But I don't want you to think that there's some sort of magic bullet, silver bullet, okay? Christian discipleship needs to do many things. It needs to address the head, the heart, and the hands. And so what I'm talking about is focusing on just one aspect of that in particular. Okay, enough with the caution. Let's move on and get a little bit more specific about worldviews and the ingredients of a worldview. I've explained what a worldview is in general terms, but what exactly goes into a worldview? If a worldview is like a cake, I'm really mixing my metaphors tonight. If a worldview is like a cake, what are the ingredients? What's the recipe for a worldview? Or to put it another way, what does it take to make a worldview? Well, a worldview, I said, involves beliefs, ideas, assumptions, and it covers at least five areas. I want to break down a worldview into five areas for you. And I've used an acronym, TAKES. That's why I put it in red there. What it takes to make a worldview, to help you remember these five areas of a worldview, okay? And here they are. The T is for theology. The A is for anthropology. And I apologize for using that word, but I needed another vowel to make it all work. So anthropology it is. I'll explain what I mean by that term shortly. Theology, anthropology. The K is for knowledge. The E is for ethics. And the S is for salvation, T-A-K-E-S, theology, anthropology, knowledge, ethics, and salvation. Let me explain each of these terms. Theology, every worldview has a theology, okay? It says something about God. It answers questions like, is there a God? What is God like? course, there are people who say they believe in God, but when you get into the details, you find out they're very different conceptions of what God is like. A theology also includes ideas about how God relates to the world. Is God the creator of the world? Is God somehow in the world? For some people, God and the world are ultimately the same. We'll talk about that worldview tomorrow. How does God relate to human beings? What is the relationship between God and humans? And the really, really personal question, the sort of existential question, how does God relate to me? That's part of a person's worldview. If there is a God, how does this God relate to me? Or how do I relate to this God? So a worldview has a theology. That's what theology means. The study of God or knowledge of God. Now you might think, well, only religious worldviews have a theology. Non-religious worldviews don't have a theology. That's not true. Everyone has a theology. Even atheists have a theology. It's just a negative theology. It's a theology that denies that there is a God. And also, atheists usually have a pretty firm idea about the kind of God they don't believe in. They have a theology too. But more generally, everyone has a God in this sense. Everyone thinks that there's some ultimate reality and that there's some ultimate authority. Whatever a person takes to be the ultimate reality and the ultimate authority is functionally their God, whether they call it God or not. So everyone has a theology. Every worldview has a theology. Secondly, the A of the T-A-K-E-S is for anthropology. Anthropology is, it's a formal academic discipline, but the word itself simply means the study of man or the study of mankind, what you believe about man. It's from the Greek word anthropos, meaning man, mankind. It's a generic term for human beings. And a person's anthropology is almost as important as their theology. Certainly what a person believes about God will affect how they view the world, but also our beliefs about ourselves, about what human beings are going to be equally significant for how they think about the world. Here are some of the questions that we might ask of a worldview to get to its anthropology. What are human beings? Are human beings creatures made in the image of God? Or are human beings just highly evolved apes that are here by some cosmic accident? Where did we come from? That, of course, is related to what kind of beings we are. What we are depends on where we came from. Are we special in any way? Is there something special about human beings that distinguishes us from all the other critters running about this planet? Are we here for a reason? And if so, what is that reason? Why do human beings exist? What are we here for? And are we basically good or bad? I was listening to an audiobook today about some great literary figure, and the person who was giving the lecture about this figure said that this person had a belief in the fundamental goodness of humanity, that all human beings are fundamentally good. Well, that was part of his worldview. Are we good? Are we bad? Are we neither? Are we somewhere in between? That's part of a person's worldview. Notice again that the answers to these questions are connected. How you answer one of these questions will affect how you answer the other questions. And in fact, all of the anthropology questions are related to the theology questions. So how you answer those theology questions will affect what you think about human beings. What you believe about God will affect what you believe about human beings. They're so intricately connected. You can't separate your theology from your anthropology, your view of who we are as beings, human beings. All right, moving on now to the K, T-A-K-E-S. The K is for knowledge. Of course, it's a silent K, but it's still a K, okay? So it still counts. Knowledge. This is what philosophers technically call epistemology, a theory of knowledge. How do we know what we know, and what do we, in fact, know? Knowledge is a good thing. I think we can all agree that knowledge is better than just opinions. If you have a friend who tells you, for example, that swallowing a raw egg every day will add 5 years to your life, you want to know, is that just your opinion? Or do you know it? And if you do know it, how do you know it? It matters whether they know it or whether they're just, you know, this is just I came up with this in a dream, all right? That's my source. Knowledge matters, whether we know things, okay? Knowledge is something worth having. It's special. And our knowledge, our view of knowledge, will be part of our worldview. What can we know about the world? Is it possible to understand the world that we live in, scientifically, economically, sociologically, politically? Can we know? What can we know about the world? What can we know about God? That would be very important. What can we know about God? How do we know what we know? It's one thing to say that you know things, but how do you know them? Do you know them by reason? Do you know them by sense experience? Do you know them by some divinely inspired scripture? Do you know them by some mystical experience or intuition? Different sources of knowledge. How do we know what we know? And are there any limits to our knowledge? Are there certain things that we just can't know? And how can we increase our knowledge? Of course, if knowledge is a good thing, we want to know, how can we grow in our knowledge? How can we gain more knowledge? And a worldview will give us some picture of what knowledge is worth having and how we can extend that knowledge. And different worldviews will have different answers to these questions. Fourthly, ethics. E is for ethics. Here I'm just using the term ethics to mean basically morality. Okay, some people talk about things like business ethics, and it's a little looser than what we mean by morality. But here I'm using the term ethics to be synonymous with morality, what we believe about right or wrong. Everyone has ethical beliefs and assumptions. Everyone. You cannot get by in life without ethical beliefs, ethical values, ethical assumptions. Turn on any cable news channel or go on some social media platform. Actually, maybe don't do that. But if you did go on some social media platform, you will be overwhelmed with ethical opinions and more than a few unethical opinions as well. People will be making ethical judgments, moral judgments all over the place. People can't help making value judgments. It's just the way that we're built. It's part of our nature to make value judgments. And our beliefs and assumptions about ethics and morality form a major part of our worldview. So here's some of the questions that we might ask of a worldview to get at its view of ethics. Is morality real or is it illusory? There are some atheists, pretty radical atheists, who will say that morality isn't real at all, that actually it's just a sort of evolutionary mechanism that doesn't really get to any truth about the world. It's an illusion that just helps us to survive. There are other people that would say the same thing, that morality isn't a real thing. But, of course, that's a major question. Are there real moral values? Are there real truths about what is right and what is wrong? Is morality objective or subjective? Does it vary from person to person? There's some people who think that what's right for me isn't necessarily right for you. Everybody has their own moral code. They are relativists or subjectivists about morality. And there are others who would say, no, morality is objective. If something's right, it's right for everyone. If something's wrong, it's wrong for everyone. There are certain objective or absolute moral laws. And how do we know? How do we know what is right or wrong? It's one thing to say certain things are right, certain things are wrong, but how do you know? Where do you get your moral knowledge from? Where do you get your moral values from? And who cares? Why should we be good anyway? It's one thing to say, this is how to be a good person. It's another thing to say, here's why you should be a good person. There's some people who will say, yeah, I know what's right, but I don't care. It's not going to get me where I want to go in life to be a moral person. What's the motivation? Why should we be good moral people? And are we accountable? The question of moral accountability. Are we accountable for the way that we live, for the moral choices that we make, to anything or to anyone? Some people will say yes, others will say no. Ethics, important part of a worldview. And then lastly, the S of the T-A-K-E-S is for salvation. Salvation. Now, here I'm using salvation in a more general sense. I'm not using it in a specifically Christian sense. When as I'm a Christian speaking to Christians, when I use the term salvation, we immediately think of the gospel. We think of what God has done to redeem us from our sin through the atonement of Christ. We have a particular Christian view of salvation. Here, though, I'm using the term salvation to simply mean this: what do you think is wrong with the world, and how does it get fixed? How does it get put right? Okay? Every worldview has something to say about what's fundamentally wrong with the world and how that can be put right. Because to most people, obviously the world isn't perfect. Very rarely would you say to someone, you think the world is perfect? Yeah, I think the world's just perfect the way it is. Nothing wrong with it at all. No one really says that. Everyone thinks that there's something wrong with the world that needs to be put right. But different worldviews take different views on what exactly is wrong with the world and what's the most fundamental problem with the world. And they also take different views on how to put things right. And that's what I call the salvation aspect of a worldview. So the sort of questions we would ask here of someone to determine their worldview on this issue: what is humanity's most serious problem? What's the fundamental problem? What's fundamentally wrong with human beings and human relationships in the world today? And what is the solution, if there is a solution? Some people might be very pessimistic and say, well, this is what's wrong with the world and there's nothing that can be done about it. But many people think, well, no, in principle, this is how it could be fixed. This would be the solution to the problem. Are there several solutions? For some religions, there are many ways of salvation. As it's sometimes said, there are many paths up the mountain. And some people follow this path, some people follow that path. So some religions are pluralistic about salvation. There are actually many solutions, many ways to get to God. If that's the problem, we need to get to God. There are many ways to get to God, some religions will say, some worldviews. And if there is a solution, what part do we have to play? Now, of course, if you're an atheist, then it's all down to us, right? God is not going to play any part in salvation. If you're an atheist and you think there's something wrong with the world, it's all up to us to fix it. But if you have a worldview which holds to the existence of God, a personal God who's active in the world, then you can ask the question, what part does God have to play? What part do we have to play in this salvation? And what part does God have to play? What does God contribute to salvation? And that can be asked, of course, of Christianity. I'll do that tomorrow morning. We'll talk about that. But it can also be asked of any religion, any other religion, and also any secular ideology as well. Every worldview, whether it's a religious worldview or a secular worldview, like Marxism would be a good example, says that there's some problem with the world, and here's the way forward. Here's the solution. Here's how things could get better. And that would be the salvation aspect of a worldview. So, T-A-K-E-S. And we'll be using this scheme right through the weekend in the other sessions that I'll be giving tomorrow. Theology, anthropology, knowledge, ethics, and salvation. That's how we can break down a worldview into what I think are the five most fundamental areas. Now, maybe I've missed something, but I think pretty much any element of a worldview can be fitted into one or more of these categories. And that can be helpful just in as a tool for analyzing worldviews. Now, we've covered a lot of ground, but there's just one more topic that I want to cover this evening, relatively briefly, just to set things up for our next session and maybe actually whet your appetite a bit to come back in the morning and hear more. All worldviews are not created equal. There are many, many worldviews out there, but they are not all created equal in the sense that they're not all on a par with one another. They're not all as good as each other. Some worldviews are clearly better than others, superior to others. And at the end of the day, logically speaking, only one worldview can actually be true. Only one worldview can actually represent the world as it really is. Some of you older folk may remember that movie, The Highlander. Do you remember the tagline of The Highlander? There can be only one. That's how it is with worldviews, ultimately. There can be only one. There can be only one that is the true worldview, that depicts the world as it really is. But even among worldviews that are not true, some are worse than others. There's sort of gradation of how good a worldview is. So how can we responsibly discriminate between worldviews? How can we make reasonable evaluations that this worldview is better than that worldview? On what basis can we say, well, this worldview is better than that one? And on what basis can we say, this one is the right one? This is the true worldview. This is the worldview that we should have. Well, basically, there are certain tests that we can apply to worldviews. There are certain tests that we can apply to worldviews to help us discern which is the one that we should hold, the one that is better than any other worldview. And I want to introduce you very briefly to four tools for testing worldviews that we'll be applying later on. Okay? There are more than four, by the way. I could double that number easily and talk about other tools that we can use, but I want to focus on four in particular. I think they'll be helpful to you. The first tool is the tool of coherence. Coherence. Coherence is a good thing for a worldview. What coherence means is something fits together well. We can ask of any worldview, do the parts of the worldview fit together well? We've seen that a worldview is made up of a number of beliefs and assumptions, but we can ask, do those beliefs and assumptions and values and ideas in that worldview cohere? Do they fit together well? If they don't, that worldview has a problem. So coherence is one important tool or test of a worldview. Second tool, tool number two, is the tool of explanation. Explanation. We can ask this question. Can this worldview, whatever worldview we're considering, can this worldview explain the very things that we take for granted in life? The things that are most obvious to us, the things that we really cannot get away from, such as, why does anything exist at all? Why is there anything at all? Why does anything exist at all? Why does the universe exist? And why does the universe exist in the sort of orderly, rational way that it does? Why are some things right or wrong? Something we take for granted. Why are some things right and wrong? There are all these basic things that we take for granted in our lives. Existence, values, reason, orderliness, human dignity. What explains them? Can this worldview explain these fundamental things about our life and our existence? Tool number three is more of a practical tool, we might say. Tool number three is what I call livability. Again, I think livability is not in the dictionary, but it should be. Someone should put it in there. You can understand what the word means. Livability is how livable is this worldview? How is it possible to live out this worldview in practice? There are some worldviews that are theoretically consistent, they're internally consistent, but no one could actually live them out in practice. They're impossible to live out in the real world. And so we can apply the livability tool or the livability test and ask, can this worldview be lived out consistently in practice? Now, we don't mean here, can it be lived out perfectly in practice? If I asked you, do you live out the Christian worldview perfectly? No, none of us do. None of us are fully consistent. But the question is really, can anyone do it in principle? Can you even begin to live out this worldview? And there are some worldviews that fail badly this livability test, and I'll talk about that later on. And then tool number four is what I call the tool of hope. The tool of hope. Again, this is more about living things out in practice. It's less about the sort of intellectual, theoretical side of worldviews, but more about what impact a worldview has in the real world, in people's real lives. We can ask of any worldview, does this worldview offer hope? Does it offer hope? Both hope in the present and hope in the future. Hope for the future. By hope in the present, I mean this. Many people are suffering great trials. Many people are going through great times of suffering and hardship, and they need hope. They need to know that things are going to get better. They need to know that what they are going through isn't pointless, isn't meaningless, that there's something that can be, as it were, redeemed from it. There are people who need hope in the present because of their circumstances. But there's also hope for the future, because at the end of the day, we're all going to die. We're all going to die. What happens next? What happens beyond that? Is there any hope beyond the grave? Is there any hope for an existence beyond death? Or is death the end of existence and the universe as a whole? Is it just going to die out? Is there any hope for the future of an existence, of a satisfaction, of a fulfillment that lasts forever, ultimately? That's a question that we can ask of a worldview. Does it offer hope in the present, in the face of suffering? Does it offer hope for the future in the face of death, decay, destruction, the end of existence? So these are four tools that we can use to test worldviews. And what we're going to do in our time tomorrow is, first of all, I'm going to talk about what the Christian worldview is. We're going to think about the Christian faith that we have in terms of a worldview and how it does extremely well when you apply these tools to it, how we can use these tools to show how meaningful and powerful the Christian worldview really is. And then later on, we're going to look at some alternatives, some rivals to the Christian worldview, and we're going to apply these tools as well, and then think about how we can lead through that to gospel conversations. So that's where we're going to go in our sessions tomorrow morning. Okay, that's all I have to say for this evening. Let me just briefly close us in a word of prayer. And by the way, I should say, if you have questions about this, and I hope you do, there's going to be a session set aside tomorrow just for questions for myself and Dr. Sasser, and we'll be happy to take those questions then. So save them up. Okay, let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that you have given us minds, and our minds are a means by which we can love you and glorify you. I pray that over this weekend, we would use our minds well. You would help us to glorify you in the way that we think about what you have revealed to us in your word, and about how we can be good ambassadors for you in this world. And I pray for those of us who will be doing the teaching, that you will help us to cleave closely to your word, to speak faithfully, to speak truly, to speak in a way that builds up the body of Christ. For we ask it in his name. Amen.